I'd like to speak a little bit on religious freedom, the intersection between church and state, and also the history. So, you know, what is this thing we call religious freedom? Why is it important? Who has it in this world today? Today, now. Have we always had it in America? If not, how do we get it? Why is it important to the Baptist church? This is a Baptist church. We bring it down to the Baptist. Why is it important to the Baptist? And what part, if any, did the Baptist church play in the First Amendment to the Constitution, which does give religious freedom in this country? What's the connection between belief, practice of religion, and the authority of the state? And further, what does the Bible say about this? And what does it tell people of faith concerning their responsibilities to the state? And I'd like to answer some of these questions this morning. We're going to start with the scriptures as of primary importance. In 1 Timothy 2, 1 and 3, it says, "First of all, then, I urge that entreaties and prayers, petitions and thanksgiving be made on behalf of all men for kings and all who are in authority." Why? "In order that we may lead a tranquil and quiet life in all godliness and dignity. This is good and acceptable in the sight of God our Savior." Remember that when this was written, the various Caesars were ruling. Okay? And probably the best of the Caesars was far worse than the worst of our presidents. Now we go back to Jeremiah 29:7. "And seek the welfare of the city where I have sent you into exile, and pray to the Lord on its behalf, for in its welfare you will have welfare." And the sense of the word translated as welfare can also mean peace. So in both of these cases, followers of God are commanded to look toward the peace or the welfare of the political government where they live. One addresses Christians in the New Testament, us, and the other speaks to Jews who were headed for exile. They're being punished for their disobedience. And God says, you're being punished, but as you're being punished, pray for the welfare of the city where I send you. And in both cases, there's a point being made. The leadership and government of any country or the various political subdivisions have a material effect on the worshipers of God. We don't live in a vacuum. Some governments are in favor of worship, some are indifferent. Others are showing various degrees of hostility. Some countries have a state religion and persecute all others. Others are officially atheistic and persecute all religions, such as the government of China. All governments are somewhere on this spectrum if we put out a line. And all governments are generally moving either toward more repressive or less repressive today at this time. So the church is not an island remote from all state control. And it's not a fortress where Christians gather and shut the doors and keep the outside out. It wasn't meant to be that. For the church is light and salt, and it's specifically meant to have an effect on the society where that church is located. We can't let our light so shine before men so that all men will see our deeds and praise God, not us, for that, if we withdraw from society behind closed doors. And so, as we worship this morning, today, this hour, this minute, we're enjoying our freedom of religion. And the Baptist Church of Revolutionary Times called this soul liberty. It's one small piece of the blessings, both religious and economic, that we have in this country. And so this morning, I want to speak about and show you the value of freedom of religion. And I want to show you that this is your heritage in a very specific and special way. The Baptists were very instrumental in securing freedom of religion in this country. And not only freedom of religion for the Baptists, but freedom of religion for everybody. And we've enjoyed this right for so long. Each and every one of us here have enjoyed this right for our entire lifetime. And we've enjoyed it for so long, we tend to take it for granted. And some people may think, as I ask, has America always had this right? And they might say, oh, yes. Oh, no. Oh, no. That's not the correct answer. And so I'd like to reflect a little this morning on how we got to where we are. Now, I do understand that this is something of a debated topic among pastors, and I have talked to pastors who say, no, I want to do expository preaching on a text, and I would never do what could be called a patriotic message. Now, I respect those men I talk to. I just don't agree with them. And so if we look at later history after Christianity was well established, the countries of Europe had a state religion. They didn't tolerate other religions. Church and state became intertwined, and the one supported the other. And religion became a means of power and position and control over the masses, money. And with all the state church had to offer to religious officials, they worked together with the secular authorities, and they stifled any competition. And various methods were used to finance the state church, mandatory tithe, taxes that went to the church. And so being the pastor of any church, whether large or small, this was a good job. Families with influence tried to get their sons educated, and they'd get them a pastorate because they got paid by the state. Didn't matter how much they worked, whether they were a good preacher, whether they were indifferent, and whether the people liked them or not, or how much the people could raise. Didn't matter, because they got paid by the state, and that was a very good job. John Bunyan, the author of Pilgrim's Progress, maybe some of you have read that work, was put into prison from 1660 to 1672 for the crime, specifically, of having assemblies. He went from place to place preaching, and the church didn't want him preaching the gospel, and the civil authorities put him in jail for that. Now, the early groups that came to America, we all have heard of the Puritans. They were Congregationalists. The Presbyterians were in New England. The southern colonies tend to be Church of England. Guess what? They all established state churches, and they all persecuted the Baptists. The colonists did have the Bible in their native tongue, which had been a battle in Europe, because the churches in Europe tended to do their services in Latin, which the people manifestly did not understand unless they were well educated. And so, not having the Bible, it was kind of a system like the scribes and Pharisees in New Testament times. What do? You do what we tell you. We know all these things. You're too stupid to know it or to figure it out for yourself. the basis for this Bible that I read today from the pulpit was laid by William Tyndale, who translated the Bible into English and had a remarkable affinity for languages. Various scholars say up to 90% of all subsequent editions rely on Tyndale's work. For his crime of translating the Bible into English, he was executed in 1536. He died to get this into English. So moving from Europe to America, we say, oh, but there was freedom in America. Well, if we go back to the year 1774, all of you American history buffs, American colonists are protesting things like the Stamp Act, the tax on tea, and various other, the Townsend's Act, various things the British were doing to raise money from the colonies. But in 1774 in Northampton, Massachusetts, there were 18 Baptists sitting in jail. What was their crime? Refusing to pay taxes for the support of the town's congregational minister. From the Massachusetts Bay Colony, I quote the following law verbatim. It is ordered and agreed that if any person or persons within this jurisdiction shall either openly condemn or oppose the baptizing of infants, or go about secretly to seduce others from the approbation of or use thereof, or shall purposely depart the congregation, walk out, at the ministration of the ordinance, after due time and means of conviction, every such person or persons shall be sentenced to banishment. If you were banished from these small colonies, you had no alternative but to go and live with the Indians or go strike out on your own. Almost a death sentence. In this same colony, a certain Obadiah Holmes came over the county border to pray with a sick family, and this was a group that did not agree with infant baptism, and they were arrested, and a large fine was imposed on two of the three men. Obadiah was whipped, and the contemporaneous accounts say they whipped him so hard that the blood ran down his legs, filled up his shoes, and overflowed for the crime of praying with a sick family. This is America, not Europe, not Iran, not Iraq. The Puritans drove out Roger Williams, who went and started Rhode Island, and as far as I know, Rhode Island was the first place in America to establish religious liberty, perhaps the first place in the world. And so we can see this morning that religious persecution was carried right over from the old world to the new world, and it found fertile ground and it sprouted and grew. So the colonies had churches that received tax funds for operations. Citizens were compelled to pay whether they agreed with the theology of that church or not. So the states had a state church. And you see the beginning of the intertwining here of church and state. Now, we all know that after the Revolution, the country was governed for a while by the Articles of Confederation. 1787, the Constitutional Convention was called, and delegates gathered to write the Constitution. And there was no Bill of Rights. Although, if you read the Constitution to this day, you'll see Article 6 contains a clause that no religious test shall ever be required as qualification for any office or public trust in the United States. A clause much forgotten when people like Amy Barrett were being selected for the Supreme Court, and they say, oh, she's a religious person. We don't want her on the court. But what they were saying, the critics at that time, was in direct contradiction to the Constitution. Madison, when he entered Congress June 8, 1789, he proposed an amendment to the Constitution saying Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof or abridging freedom of speech or of the press or the right to people peaceably to assemble and petition the government for redress of grievances. And so when the Bill of Rights was adopted in 1791, this became our First Amendment. Governs the country to this day. The Baptists felt secure, and long afterwards, Madison was writing to Robert Walsh from Mount Pelier in March 2, 1819. And here's what he said, and this is very important. It was the universal opinion of the century preceding the last that civil government could not stand without the prop of a religious establishment, and that the Christian religious itself would perish if not supported by legal provision for the clergy. The experience of Virginia conspicuously corroborates the disproof of both opinions. The civil government, though bereft of anything like an associated hierarchy, possesses the requisite stability and performs its function with complete success, whilst the number, the industry, and the morality of the priesthood and the devotion of the people have been manifestly increased by the separation of the church from the state. It's very early, and this is one of our founding fathers writing this, and they thought that the church would wither away unless the state took money from the people and gave it to the church. And they also thought the state would be much disadvantaged if the church wasn't there as more or less a partner. So you might be asking, how did the First Amendment for religious liberty bud and blossom when the ground was full of religious persecution in the United States? I'm glad you asked. I quote now Bacon, who was a historian that wrote about this time. In the establishment of the American principle of the non-interference of the state with religion and the equality of all religious communions before the law, much was due, no doubt, to the mutual jealousies of the sects, no one or two of which were strong enough to maintain exceptional pretensions over the rest combined. Much also to be imputed to the indifferentism and sometimes anti-religious sentiment of an important and numerous class of doctrinaire politicians, of which Jefferson may be taken as a type. So far as this work was a work of intelligent conviction and religious faith, the chief honor of it must be given to the Baptists. Other sects, notably the Presbyterians, had been energetic and efficient in demanding their own liberties. The Friends and Baptists agreed in demanding liberty of conscience and worship and equality before the law for all alike. But the active labor in this cause was mainly done by the Baptists. It is to their consistency and constancy in the warfare against the privilege of the powerful standing order of New England and of the moribund establishments in the South that we are chiefly indebted for the final triumph in this country of that principle of separation of church and state, which is one of the largest contributions of the New World to civilization and the church universal. Quoted from Bacon, A History of American Christianity. As late as the beginning of the 19th century, there was still a dream by some of a state church. Thomas Jefferson, writing to Benjamin Rush, noted the clergy had a hope of attaining an establishment of a particular form of Christianity through the United States, and especially the Episcopalians and the Congregationalists. But Jefferson promised to oppose that effort. Massachusetts, by the way, did not ratify the First Amendment to the Constitution. The suggested amendment, of course, came from the Baptists. And this is from Cathcart in his centennial offering. No community asked for this change in the Constitution but the Baptists. The Quakers probably would have petitioned it if they had thought of it, but they did not. John Adams and the Congregationalists did not desire it. The Episcopalians did not wish it. It went too far for most Presbyterians in revolutionary times, or in our days when we hear so much about putting the divine name in the Constitution. The Baptists asked it through Washington. The request commended itself to his judgment and to the generous soul of Madison. And to the Baptists, beyond a doubt, belongs the glory of engrafting its best articles on the noblest constitution ever framed for the government of mankind. That, again, is a quote from Cathcart. And so, you might ask, what are the fruits of this religious liberty? The state churches in Europe are still funded by taxes. Magnificent cathedrals, which stand empty or with a mere handful of congregants. In this country, there are many churches. Especially you go down south, seems like there's a Baptist church on every corner. We attend churches we wish, we send our children. And we may well forget that teaching children the Bible is a crime in many places. The freedom of religion in this country has spawned the building of innumerable churches, hospitals, orphanages, both here and all over the world. It's fueled the greatest missionary movement the world has ever seen. We have missionaries far-flung, South America, Hungary, Bangladesh. I knew some in Africa. I have pastor friends in India. So we have all these things, missionary stations, clinics, orphanages, schools, Robert Carey Academy, which is a Christian school in Bangladesh where the elite Muslims send their children to school because it's the best education to be had. Translators are working every day to translate the Bible into a myriad of languages. We have some of the best Christian books and various helps to be found anywhere in the history of Christianity. Christian programs. Someone was talking to me this morning about a program they were watching on TV. A freedom of religion has borne a great deal of fruit. But freedom of religion is not the norm around the world. It's the exception rather than the rule. Those who came to America for religious freedom wished to educate their children so they could read and understand the Bible, and it became the foundation of the public school system, foundation for a literate population, people who could read and understand. And so, as we read our Bible, we see the disciples preaching in the New Testament, and after Peter's sermon, people ask him, "What are we to do?" And here in Acts chapter 2, we see persuasion, not compulsion. Because obviously some listened and said, what are we to do? And others turned away and said, I'm not going to listen. And it's shown through the book of Acts as Paul and others go, and they go in the synagogue and they reason with the people. They had no political power. They had no secular power. And they didn't want any. And I would say the same thing for this church today. Do I want to require people to come to church? No. Do I want to require people to make a profession of faith, whether it's real or not? No. The Christian becomes light and salt by testimony and good works. And as Christians, we don't force anyone to believe as we do. We bear witness to the promise of God. We bear witness to the gifts of God. So others wish to have these same things. Others say, what is it about this person? Of course, they seem peculiar to me. And I would like to know why. We want to persuade, not compel. And so we don't seek governmental power. Rather, we seek to be free from governmental power. Don't tell us what to do, and we won't tell you what to do. Now, Baptists in general, and fundamental Baptists in particular, are often painted by secular society as being narrow-minded, intolerant, mean. Okay? And as a general rule, this is because we refuse to compromise on the message of Scripture. Anyone that calls sin, sin, is not going to be beloved. That's a fact. And Baptists wish to live in a Christ-honoring manner among a wicked and sinful generation. Those who don't believe in God are not going to understand. Paul writes in 1 Corinthians 1:18, for the word of the cross is to those who are perishing foolishness, but to us who are being saved, it's the power of God. And so you can see there's a divide there. And the Christian of today wants to show the message and power of Christ until he comes back. We can count on being labeled intolerant when we refuse to water down the Scriptures to please those who call evil good and good evil. You can bet on that. But it's a historical fact that the freedom of religion that we enjoy in America today through the First Amendment to our Constitution is a direct result of the actions of the Baptist Church in America at that time. Cannot be denied, and it cannot be disputed, because the other bigger churches would have liked to have been the state religion copied from Europe. The Independent Baptist Church is a model of the free exercise of religion. Many churches have a central governing body, and they have control of accepted church doctrine. They own the church property, they assign pastors, and they have control over the funds. They control things like wages or pensions. And so this sort of economic and doctrinal power make it hard to argue with a central authority. And we see that played out in various lawsuits today where the central authority, the denomination, gets very liberal. And some of the local churches don't like it, and they say, we won't accept that. And the denomination says, all right, here's a church you built and paid for. Get out. We own it. And this is happening. And in large measures, the courts have upheld the ownership of the denomination, that the local church has to get out, become independent, build their own church. They're going to face the same choices that led to the formation of the General Association of Regular Baptist Churches. Do we stay and do we submit to this doctrine which we abhor, or do we cut our losses and walk away? The independent Baptist churches have what we call congregational control over aspects of worship. That includes calling a pastor, financial decisions like putting in a new heating system or other projects. No conference or external authorities can hinder these projects or claim the property after it's all finished. You don't get control from the outside. You don't get some help from the outside. You're going to stand or fall on your own. So the local church has got to take responsibility and liability. This church has been at that for over 50 years now. Now, there's a lot more I could say, because I really get revved up on this subject, but time is lacking to speak of it all. Freedom, I will conclude with, is a very precious gift, but it's of little value if it's not used. So you may have all the freedom in the world to worship as you please, testify, evangelize, and so forth, but that freedom is like something sitting in the corner covered with cobwebs if you don't use it. This is the first Sunday in the month, and so we will be observing communion.